Hello. On this week's program, Susan Lewis explores the life and work of Beethoven, whose music continues to enthrall modern audiences and is now featured in 3 weeks of programs at the Philadelphia Orchestra. David Patrick Stearns reports on the rise and rise of Eileen Perez, a soprano whose career began in Philadelphia, recently starred in the Royal Opera House's production of La Traviata. We speak with Robert Whitman. He writes of his years as head of the FBI's art crime team in Priceless, How I Went Undercover to Rescue the World's Stolen Treasures. And Eric Brannon takes us to the American Swedish Historical Museum in Philadelphia. That's all I have this morning on Creatively Speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Along with Bach and Brahms, Beethoven stands as one of the three big B's in classical music. Among his numerous works, he wrote 9 great symphonies, 5 piano concertos, an oratorio, an opera, a violin concerto, and 16 string quartets. This month, the Philadelphia Orchestra is devoting 3 weeks of programming to this musical master. Now, WRTI's Susan Lewis explores Beethoven, the man, and his music.
Today, Beethoven is an icon, his music a beacon, reaching out to even the youngest musicians.
For me, it was amazing when I was playing Beethoven 5 for the first time, and I was like, oh my God, this is amazing.
Conductor Gustavo Dudamel, now the music director of the Los Angeles Philharmonic, got his early musical training in Venezuela's Simón Bolívar Youth Orchestra.
I was one day playing a concert in my town with the Simón Bolívar Orchestra. I remember that there were 8,000 or 9,000 people listening. And when we start, yeah, dun, 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 they were screaming, you know.
Born in Bonn, Germany in 1770, Ludwig van Beethoven came of age in Europe during the tumultuous time of the French Revolution. With a father who hoped he'd be the next Mozart, Ludwig learned music seriously from an early age. He studied piano, organ, and viola, and moved to Vienna in 1792, where he studied with Haydn. Unlike many of his peers who maintained church or court positions, Beethoven worked as an independent musician, earning his living from patron support as well as income from concerts and sales of his works. Bruce Adolph, composer and resident lecturer at the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center, says Beethoven changed the nature of the way music was written and understood.
Beethoven is an extreme example of someone who was always breaking new ground, always considering new ideas, forever looking for a new way to hear, a new kind of harmony, a new kind of cadence, a new kind of drama.
The result was universal music infused with intensity of both joy and suffering that was interpreted in various ways. Richard Friedman, professor of music at Haverford College, says different schools of musicians who came afterward claimed him as a model.
They're seeing in Beethoven a mirror of their own interests. So if you want music to be about itself, for the Brahms Hanslick camp in Vienna in the 1870s and 1880s, that's exactly how they were able to read Beethoven. But for the Liszt Wagner camp, who wanted to see music as a reflection of ideas outside itself, Beethoven's music became the model of extra-musical expression in musical form.
How Beethoven's life affected his music has been subject to speculation. While he became successful in his own time as a performer, composer, and conductor, his personal struggles had all the drama of opera. His mother died when he was 16, his father struggled with alcohol addiction, and the teenage Ludwig assumed care of his 2 younger brothers. He had at least 1 doomed love affair. At 26, he famously began losing his hearing. His growing deafness made performing increasingly difficult, but he continued to compose. He died at age 56. Composer and Curtis faculty member Virginia Allen has studied Beethoven's personal sketches, letters, and papers.
One of the things that you see very clearly about Beethoven was that he was very passionate. He was passionate about his music. He was passionate about good things. He was also passionate when things went badly. And that passion comes across so clearly within his music.
While the passion in Beethoven's music was no doubt informed by his personal experience, Richard Friedman says his composition should not be read as a biographical record of his emotional ups and downs. Even the way his music has been categorized for study reflects the benefit of hindsight. Described by textbooks as a bridge between classicism and romanticism, Beethoven's works are often grouped by scholars into three periods. The early works, until about 1802, adhering to classical convention, resembled the work of Haydn. During a middle period, Beethoven composed a variety of big, masterful works, including his Third through Eighth Symphonies. The Third, first performed in 1804, known as the Eroica Symphony. The idea of heroic struggle has been linked with Beethoven's style throughout this period between 1802 and 1815, when he also wrote numerous other compositions, among them his violin concerto, the opera Fidelio, string quartets, and piano sonatas.
Beethoven's works break with convention, and in fact, the works of the period around 1802, 1803, the new way that he spoke about himself, was a very self-conscious act of creating a new way of writing music, and this is the so-called heroic style that really is about transferring some of the idiom of symphonic music into the world of chamber and piano music. And so it's not just about forms, but it's about the cross-fertilization of genres. And the interesting thing with Beethoven is that not only did he do that, but he was quite self-conscious about that, and this idea of a heroic struggle in his music.
Beethoven was aware that he was defying public expectations with some of his music. Virginia Allen points to his string quartet, Opus 95, written in 1810, which premiered before a private gathering in 1814.
He wrote a letter to Sir George Smart over in England, and he said that this was not to be performed in public. It was to be performed just for a small circle of connoisseurs, and he really believed that it was something that would be so unfamiliar to audiences who were used to listening to salon music that was more entertaining, that this would be difficult for some people to be able to understand.
His Opus 95, though technically in his middle period, showed characteristics of what was to come. During what's called his late period, from 1816 to his death in 1827, he composed works such as his great late string quartets that seemed to baffle his contemporaries.
They're 5, 6, 7 movements long. They're huge theme and variation pieces, huge fugues. These are difficult, big pieces. In lots of ways, they really were works of the 20th century. And to the extent that 19th century listeners heard them, they thought that Beethoven had gone off his rocker, and the chief explanation of those pieces really was Beethoven's deafness.
Despite Beethoven's increasing personal isolation as his deafness worsened, and the puzzled reception his later works may have endured, Beethoven emerges from history a triumph. His music so innovative, so alive, so daring, that as often as it's played, it still has the ability to alternately move us, then take us by surprise.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. The Philadelphia Orchestra's 3 weeks of Beethoven continue tonight with a program including his violin concerto featuring Arabella Steinbecker.
Thank you. You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Philadelphia opera goers have watched soprano Eileen Perez grow from an unusually polished student at the Academy of Vocal Arts to an even more polished leading soprano, not just in recent Opera Company of Philadelphia productions, but now in Europe, where she recently made her debut singing Violetta in La Traviata at the Royal Opera House in Covent Garden. The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns met her in London after her dress rehearsal and reports that Perez was strangely unintimidated by the great singers of the past who have sung La Traviata on the Covent Garden stage. In fact, she finds their ghosts encouraging.
Eileen Perez seems remarkably at home backstage at the Royal Opera House. From the security guards to the chorus to people we ran into in the elevator, they seem to have known her for a million years.
Okay, fantastic. Okay. Yes. And I've invited my parents to the last performance. Good. I would like them to take a look.
Yes, that's a pleasure.
Great.
Yeah.
Bye.
Who's that?
Peter Katna. He does the casting here.
Going down.
Going for a tour.
Mind the doors. Doors closing.
Pretty, talented, and considerate of everybody around her, Perez endears herself with something more subtle. She's a listener. You can see it on stage. You sense her character making decisions at that very moment based on what's going on around her. She looks fellow singers in the eye. There's a personal energy exchange. That's not typical in opera, where singers often stake out and guard their turf. Perez, in contrast, is excited about singing with a top-flight cast, if only because she doesn't have to worry about them.
There's nothing better than being next to a great singer that, I mean, it makes you feel better in the sense that you know you don't have to be nervous for them. You can fully sing out. You don't have to worry about them. You worry about yourself, and you know their level of excellence makes everyone play better.
In such company, Perez is able to make new discoveries in a role whose steep vocal demands are matched by the psychological ones. Portraying a terminally ill courtesan who suddenly meets the love of her life, Perez was uncovering fine details as late as the Act 3 dress rehearsal when she arrives at a party on the arm of an elderly baron.
I felt something new today where I realized my music, Voi Barone, is actually very formal, you know, Voi Barone. I've never been on stage with a baron who was decorated. And I think I will be even, hopefully, more aware of my surroundings, the less I'm concerned about singing it, how much it frees you up to just take in the room, the energy, the playfulness.
Eileen Perez unashamedly admits to a more superficial source of inspiration, her dress. When the production was new in the 1980s, Angela Gheorghiu became a star in that dress, both on stage and on the cover of the subsequent recording.
I didn't realize when I came in for a fitting that it was, you know, the 1994 George Holti, Gheorghiu, big Richard Eyre production, until I saw the black dress. And I just remember because that was on the cover of the album. And I thought, oh my God, this is it. You know, I just thought, oh, this is, I'm on top of the world. And I warned everyone here that if it goes missing, you know.
Success in London isn't new to Eileen Perez. The Traviata excerpts heard here are from a recital she gave there in 2009. She has also sung with the Royal Opera, though on its 2010 tour of Japan. She was pressed into service when the scheduled soprano was too ill to continue her Traviata on opening night in Tokyo. Her final curtain was greeted with an audience roar, according to members of the chorus who were there. Perez probably wouldn't have mentioned it unless I had.
I'll never forget that moment. It was definitely a spectacular evening in the sense that I've never seen a public that happy, that appreciative and on their feet. And I think it speaks hopefully to my performance, but also it should speak of how everyone just made it all work. You know, what I remember beyond the ovation, when the curtain came to a close, then the chorus and everyone else congratulating me backstage. So it was another roar, and I'll never forget it.
That's why she seems to belong in a place that many singers aspire to, but few reach. Having grown up in the Chicago area, Perez trained at Indiana University in an opera department so large that promising singers sometimes get lost. But she didn't. The Academy of Vocal Arts is no picnic either, but she not only won leading roles right away, but met her future husband, the also up-and-coming tenor Stephen Costello. Now, the two intersect with each other all over the world. Only a few days previously, Costello arrived to join Perez in London. In moments like this, you want to stop, stand back, and snap a mental picture of Perez and Costello walking through London's West End at dusk, with Costello looking for a place that he knows will deliver the perfect burger. Success for both continues and continues. So do the pressures, artistic and personal. But that's for another day.
The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns. Robert Whitman spent 20 years as an FBI special agent. His early training in music and Eastern art and antiques made him ideally suited to investigating art crimes. Assigned to the Philadelphia Field Division, he was instrumental in solving many high-profile arts and antiquities crimes, including thefts from the Rodin Museum, the Penn Museum, and the Pennsylvania Historical Society. Over the course of his career, Whitman estimates he had a hand in the recovery of more than $225 million worth of stolen art and cultural property, and in the prosecution and conviction of numerous art thieves both in the U.S. and abroad. He details many of these investigations and his own personal struggles in his memoir, Priceless, How I Went Undercover to Rescue the World's Stolen Treasures. I met with Robert Whitman at his home in the Philadelphia suburbs. Despite the fact that even as a young boy you wanted to be in the FBI, your eventual route there was rather circuitous. The experience you had before going into the Bureau somewhat contributed to you eventually having this interest in solving art crimes.
Right. Well, you know, what had happened was my dad was very much interested in art and antiques. He was in Japan right after the Second World War, during the Korean War, and he met my mother. And my father was collecting antiques at that time in Japan. And he brought many back to the States with him and got involved in the antiques business. And I kind of grew up around that whole setting, you know, with the art and antiques. And as a result, it wasn't so much I learned about antiques as much as I learned about the business of art and antiques. And that's really what is important when you do undercover work, trying to recover these paintings. You know, you can learn the art history, but you can't learn how to do business. I was also a classical music aficionado. I loved piano music. And even in college, when I was in college, my first year in college, I was thinking about being a performance major for piano. And, you know, as a result, I fell in love with all the classics. So it kind of went hand in hand.
Tell us some of the standout cases that you investigated.
Some of the interesting pieces, the Bill of Rights, the copy that was stolen from North Carolina in 1865, one of only 14 original copies of the Bill of Rights. We recovered that when someone tried to sell that to the National Constitution Center. Another interesting case was a Rembrandt self-portrait valued at about $35 million that had been stolen at gunpoint from the Swedish National Museum in Stockholm. That case took us almost 6 years to solve. In the end, we were able to recover that piece in an undercover operation in Copenhagen, Denmark. There have been many, many interesting cases. Another one was a battle flag, a Civil War battle flag that was carried in a battle by the 12th Regiment Corps d'Afrique, which was an African-American U.S. Army regiment. And in that battle of Port Hudson, I believe 4 to 5 people were shot out from under the flag. So it was considered to be a blood cloth. You know, what's interesting is that the value of that particular flag was about $30,000 on the open market. Of course, the Rembrandt was valued at $35 million that we spoke about. But, you know, the true value of the two pieces is not the financial. It's not the monetary. It's the cultural history and a cultural value. You know, what's worth more? A regimental battle flag that symbolizes the end of slavery and freedom for, a large segment of our population, or a painting that was done in 1630. Both are very valuable. Both are important, but they both have immense cultural value.
You narrate in the book the fact that the gentleman who tried to sell you the flag was one of the dumbest criminals you'd ever come across. Tell us about who were the more clever ones you came across.
You know, I wouldn't say they were clever. I think that the real art and art theft is the selling of the piece, not the stealing. All these individuals were good at stealing, okay? They were good criminals, put it that way. When I say good, I mean they were proficient in their chosen profession. Just for example, the guys who stole the Rembrandt, they went into the Swedish National Museum, they had machine guns, they put everybody on the floor, they had two car bombs go off on the main roads that led to the museum from the mainland. They made their getaway after stealing three paintings. There was two Renoirs and the Rembrandt in a speedboat. So, you know, were they proficient criminals? Yeah, they got away with it. But they got caught in the end because they tried to sell them. And in the end, they sell them to the police. You know, were they good criminals? No. Most of them were not proficient. I mean, they were not smart or clever or charming. There's not many Pierce Brosnans out there in the crime world.
The Gardner Museum heist from 1990 is probably one of the greatest unsolved art thefts. Is it something that you still ponder, now retired from the FBI?
Oh, I ponder it, of course. It's my belief and in my opinion that the paintings are in France. I think that we were within maybe 2 weeks of recovering the Vermeer and the Rembrandt. The Vermeer is called the Concert. It's a masterpiece. It's the only Vermeer missing in the world. The Rembrandt was the storm over the Sea of Galilee. It's the only seascape Rembrandt ever did. I worked for almost 2 years in an undercover operation involving Miami, Boston, and Paris. And it's my belief that those paintings are still in Marseille, in the south of France.
In someone's collection?
Not so much in a collection. There are gangs in France that do these types of thefts. It's not the only thing they do. They're also involved in drug running. They're also involved in money laundering and murder. But they also steal art. And they do it for two purposes. One purpose is to try to sell it. If they can't sell it, they save it. And then what they use it for is get out of jail free cards. In other words, they can turn around at that point, negotiate some type of settlement when they get caught for other crimes, and use those paintings as negotiating chips. So, you know, these gangs are known to be doing that. There's a group called the La Brise La Mer in Marseille that are very much involved in these types of heists.
So you expect these paintings will show up at some point?
Yeah, I think the fact that we didn't get them back is, of course, a loss, but really the epic victory in that investigation, in my belief, is to know that they exist. They're not destroyed, you know, they still exist, and that gives you hope of the possibility and probability of recovering them.
Could you steal any painting?
Could I steal a painting?
Hmm.
You mean practically, I guess anyone could steal a painting. I would never do
that. With your specialized knowledge, could you walk into a museum and say, yes, I can have any one of these paintings based on my knowledge of how they're secured?
Sure, if I wanted to get caught.
Robert Whitman. His best-selling memoir is Priceless, How I Went Undercover to Rescue the World's Stolen Treasures. The Patterson Avenue section of South Philadelphia is best known as the home of the city's sports complex, a conurbation of great hulking sculptures reflecting a popular part of the city's identity and recent history. Yet in the shadow of these stadiums is an institution that explores a culture that helped shape the very existence of Philadelphia and the surrounding region. Built in 1926 and nestled in FDR Park in a neoclassical revival building, is the American Swedish Historical Museum. Now, as WRTI's Eric Brannan reports, the museum serves to remind visitors of the long history of the influence of the Swedish people on the Delaware Valley.
Traces of Philadelphia's Swedish heritage are easy to find. Take a close look at the city's seal or its flag. Their motif of blue and gold vertical stripes bears a strong resemblance to Sweden's national flag, which features a gold cross on a blue background. This is no coincidence, according to the Swedish Historical Museum's executive director, Tracy Beck.
That is all based on the fact that the Swedes were the first Western settlers in this area, and so their colors were sort of embraced by the state and the cities around here.
In 1638, decades before William Penn and his fellow Quakers arrived, a small group of Swedish settlers came to the region. Along the banks of the Delaware River in modern-day Delaware, Pennsylvania, and New Jersey, they formed the New Sweden Colony. Kim Erik Williams, historian at the Swedish Colonial Society and director of the Swedish Language Program at the University of Pennsylvania, says that settlements like New Sweden were potentially lucrative endeavors.
The idea was to come establish a fort and then trade with the Indians, get enough furs that you possibly could, take them back to Europe and make money. And the only settlements you had would be a couple farms around the fort which were necessary for food for the soldiers to keep the place going.
One of the museum's many exhibition spaces, the New Sweden Gallery, is dedicated to chronicling the first 60 years of the Swedish presence in America. Thanks to a gift from Esther Ann McFarland, a direct descendant of one of the original colonists, the space has recently undergone a major renovation. Executive Director Tracy Beck says that the new gallery gives a more focused look at where the Swedish settlements were and how, after a brief takeover by the Dutch, the British staked their claim.
We had someone create an animated map that shows from 1638, when the Swedes arrived in Delaware, until about 1700, where there are documented things like forts, blockhouses, churches, where we know the people were settling. So you can kind of watch the map as it changes from, and you get more Swedes, and then you see the British arrive with William Penn, and then you see the British take over. The Swedes are still there, but you can see how they were totally engulfed by the British by 1700.
Beck says that one of the reasons the British were so much more successful was mostly thanks to their greater resources.
The Swedes didn't have regular influxes coming from Sweden. So there were several ships that came, but sometimes it would be years between ships that brought provisions and more settlers.
The Swedes relied heavily on trade with the Native American population. This relationship is depicted in a mural covering the towering ceiling of the museum's grand lobby. Compared to other colonial powers like the Dutch and the English, the Scandinavian settlers peacefully coexisted with the Native Americans. According to the museum's curator, Carrie Hogan, their low profile was out of necessity.
The Swedes were very judicious. They were always outnumbered in so many respects. So they played it safe. They traded very carefully. They were nonviolent.
Though the colonial Swedes had all but assimilated into the British colony by 1700, today there are still many historic Swedish sites still preserved in the region. They consist of old Swedes' churches, parks, and historic log cabins, another part of New Sweden's legacy. Kim Erik Williams says many of the first Swedish settlers came from heavily forested areas and helped introduce log cabin construction to America.
This particular method of building a house, which three Swedish settlers, three men, could build a log cabin in a day. And that log cabin was good for 60 years. They were expert woodsmen. And this was a perfect sort of place to live in a country like America, which was filled with forests.
In addition to examining the lives of Swedish settlers in America, the museum also illustrates what life was like in colonial-era Sweden, says Executive Director Tracy Beck.
This is the stuga, which is a representation of what a one-room house in Sweden might have looked like. And so we have the corner fireplace that is typical of a Swedish home.
The Swedish Historical Museum houses 12 permanent galleries, including the stuga. There's a room that envelops visitors with a map of 17th century Sweden painted on walls covered with bronze leaf, while another gallery is dedicated to the Nobel Prize, founded by Swedish inventor and entrepreneur Alfred Nobel. Kim Erik Williams says that in the U.S. today, there are estimated to be over 20 million people of Swedish ancestry. Though many may be unaware of their colonial heritage, historical churches, scholarly research, and institutions like the American Swedish Historical Museum are there as a reminder of the lasting legacy of the new Swedes.
WRTI's Eric Brannan. And that's our program for this week. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at our website, wrti.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ripchester, and performed by Symphony and Sea under music director Rossin Milnoff. Eric Brannan is our associate producer. The show's executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.